From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A recent report by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities concluded that TANF, the government welfare program known as Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is reaching fewer poor families. The number of poor Americans receiving assistance dipped to a low in 2014 and has remained there. The report concludes that TANF's work requirements and block grant structure exacerbate rather than reduce deep poverty. There was a time when the idea of welfare was not anathema in the US, but decades of demonizing the poor and blaming them for their plight has deeply skewed US government policy, ensuring that there's always money for militarism and corporate subsidies or tax cuts for the rich, and never enough money for the most vulnerable Americans. Now, a new book suggests that a feminist perspective is needed to right this wrong. My guest is Felicia Kornbluh, Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. Her earlier book is The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics and Poverty in Modern America. And she's the co-author with Gwendolyn Mink of the new book. It's called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. Welcome to the program, Felicia.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this idea that welfare is a bad thing, that it is fostering dependence, which you often hear from members of the Republican Party, but even some Democrats, how far back does that go? I think of Clinton, who signed welfare reform, but really before him, it started with Reagan, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it's an old idea. In America, you could go back even to, you know, when the African Americans who had been enslaved, you know, were emancipated in the Reconstruction period. And there's a lot of talk about people being lazy when, in fact, people are working incredibly hard. And then, right, the 20th century versions of this were really strong in the Reagan period. Reagan built his career in California when he was running for governor, talking about the so-called welfare queen. The woman who supposedly was receiving benefits she wasn't entitled to. And the really remarkable thing that we write about is how that idea found its way into the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And so even though we understand that conservatives are very much to blame for what's happened, we really want Democrats and progressives and feminists and liberals, you know, people who call themselves by those names, to take a good hard look at their politics and to be willing to rethink the politics of the 1990s.
So the idea of welfare is that the government, using the money of taxpayers, should be ensuring that the most vulnerable among us don't fall through the cracks, you know, are saved from starvation, but more than that, also given the help that they need in order to get back on their feet, or if they just need help for various reasons, get the help. But the idea of welfare has been linked to work. And so now we have this idea of welfare to work. Tell us what it was that Bill Clinton signed, the seminal bill, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. I have to read it because I can't remember it so long, but it has all these buzzwords, personal responsibility, opportunity. These are Republican buzzwords. What did this act do in changing welfare in the U.S.?
Well, I consider this law kind of the original sin of the modern Democratic Party. And that's because we can really see a before and an after. Even though in the old days, you know, our anti-poverty programs were never perfect. Women who are raising kids on the economic margins have never, you know, have never been sort of living high on the hog. But after 1996, what this law did was it said that even if a family, let's say a mom and her kid or two kids, even if they meet all the criteria, the federal criteria, the whatever eligibility standards their own state might implement, they're still not assured that they'll get assistance when they need it. At the national level, there is a maximum of 5 years that anybody could ever receive help over her whole lifetime, right? So if you have, let's say you have two kids and you're trying to get them into full day school, that 5 years isn't going to cover it. I mean, let's say you have the misfortune of being in an abusive relationship and you need to get out and you need some help. If you've already received benefits at some other point in your life, those benefits aren't going to be there that second time when you need the help. So it eliminated the so-called entitlement to aid. It's no longer an entitlement. It instituted instead this 5-year national time limit and allowed the states to have even lower time limits. It expressly allowed the states to institute what are called family caps, which we see as a real challenge to people's reproductive justice, allowing the states to not give any additional aid when you have an additional child. So effectively, you know, you lower the amount of money that somebody has for themselves and their family. And it instituted new controls on immigrants, even people with documentation. And this is a policy signed by the Democrats that said that if you are a legal documented immigrant, you cannot receive a whole range of benefits, not just this temporary assistance to needy families, but it also put in a bar for people who may need disability insurance or might need food stamps or what's called the SNAP program. So it really was a very, very much of a landmark piece of legislation, and landmark not in a good sense, in a negative sense.
And Bill Clinton signed it. He championed it. This is, you know, in so many ways, a big reason why people who are on the liberal side or left side of the political spectrum just don't trust the establishment Democratic Party, because you've had Bill Clinton, you know, do stuff like this. Now, this particular bill and the welfare program in general is one that disproportionately impacts women, right? Hence, this idea that you have these decisions being taken by a male-dominated government without thinking about how it impacts women. I'm thinking also sort of an analogy is how the reproductive justice movement is hampered by the fact that it's often men in positions of power making decisions. Is it the same? Is the same true for decision making and policy making on welfare, that we've had this anti-feminist, anti-woman ideology at the heart of all of this?
Well, I think so. And I would even go further and say, what it represents, it's not just the people involved, you know, but it's the substance of their decisions. And I think it really represents a misunderstanding of what's going on in American families and a misunderstanding of the work that many, many people do, but disproportionately women are the ones who are doing it. And I mean, you know, the work is the work of raising children, the work of, you know, reproducing our culture, reproducing our society, the work of caring for our elders, the work of making sure that when people are ill and disabled, that they have necessary support. Even the work of, you know, waiting in the doctor's office, waiting in the welfare office in order to get whatever resources are necessary for family survival. Like, that's work that has to be done, right? And it's disproportionately done by women, not just by women. And it's historically, it's a kind of work that has been associated with women or has been feminized. We call it, you know, caregiving or caretaking. And it's critically important to the survival of our society and our culture. And, you know, not only is it not recognized, but it seems like it's demeaned in our culture. And when we have a welfare policy that just makes it harder and harder and harder for people raising kids to survive, and that says, you know, we want you to work and we're not going to promise you childcare and we're not going to give you access to education and training and all those things. I think it's the most blatant kind of anti-feminism that we could imagine. And it's not just men who did it or have done it. But certainly men have been in the majority in the White House and in the Congress and so on.
And a lot of that has to do with how our economy is structured, right? With women who are expected to do all of the work of caregiving, including child rearing or taking care of the elderly, but not given the government support that they would need or they need to make that happen. They just have to figure out ways to do it all. And if you happen to be in the middle class or upper classes, you somehow manage, especially in the middle class. And if you fall anywhere lower, you can't manage no matter how hard you try. Is that what you mean when you say our current system is ensuring poverty, as the title of your book implies?
Yeah, that's exactly what we mean. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to look very far to find, you know, situations or times when even our culture, even our not very generous culture, did it better. Like in the big welfare program that was created right before the Bill Clinton era, there actually was a major welfare reform in the 80s that was a bipartisan thing. And there were a lot of problematic aspects of that, but there was one really good aspect, which is that the federal government said, okay, we want people to be in the labor market, but we're also going to allow people to get education. And there actually was a big public investment in education programs. And you saw in community colleges all over the country, there were programs created for low-income moms who were going to be leaving the welfare rolls and who needed some, you know, some access to education and training. And the time that people spent getting educated was counted as work, which it is. It's a form of work. And that was eliminated in 1996. And people's access to work and training was really cut off and cut down to the bone, even while there was a lot of rethoric about how we were going to be providing opportunity and promoting responsibility and it was going to be a contract and so on. It was, you know, kind of classic neoliberalism, a one-way contract imposed on the poor people, the people with less power in the situation. And there were no particularly enforceable aspects of that contract that people could bring up with the people who had political power.
How much of our current approach to welfare is also rooted in racist stereotyping? Do our policies disproportionately impact poor women of color?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is it's a great example of what academic and some other feminists call intersectional politics. And we try and kind of spell this out in the book, that you know, there is a feminist politics like somebody like a Sheryl Sandberg, right, where she says all we have to do is lean in and, you know, assert our power and stuff like this. And for some, you know, wealthy white women, maybe that makes sense. Maybe that gets them somewhere. But what we're talking about is a politics in which women of color are disproportionately affected and where the stereotypes that are really driving the bus in terms of public policy are at the same time racialized and gendered stereotypes. And the only way that we can really unpack that and I think get over it, recover from this stage of our politics, is to understand that and is to start to understand the world and take a view of the world from the perspective of low-income women of color who face a kind of unique set of challenges and circumstances and who have been right in the crosshairs of the worst kind of popular stereotyping. And Democrats as well as Republicans have been really, really complicit with that. And I think without our nation's racial legacy and without a particular kind of backlash against the civil rights movement and the women's movement, I don't think that we would be seeing these kinds of public policies.
We are entering an era where both the Democratic and Republican parties are being challenged from the grassroots by new and very inspiring newly elected members of Congress. The midterm election saw a wave of very outspoken women who were unexpectedly elected, at least unexpected for the establishment, who themselves have experienced poverty, who've been on government assistance programs, who've struggled to make ends meet, and who are bringing this fresh perspective into government. Do you feel that that can help tilt government policy in the right direction and bring that desperately needed feminist perspective?
Well, I certainly hope so. I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful. The other day, I had the opportunity to talk with a former member of Congress, Representative Lynn Woolsey from California, and she is somebody who received public aid for herself and her kids when she needed it, and she brought that perspective when she was in Congress. So I do think that it changes your view, you know, if you have that history and if you're honest about your history and you're true to your roots, the way it seems like, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York is, you know, really honest about her own roots. And
we had Deb Haaland from New Mexico, who's also very, right? Someone who's who's spoken about her past. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's very promising. I think in terms of the Democratic Party, you know, a process started in 2016 during the primaries, and that process was kind of curtailed because then it was like all hands on deck to try and defeat Donald Trump. And then, of course, that didn't go so well. So I think there's an incomplete conversation. And now it's time to complete that conversation and to really say, hey, wait a minute, guys, like this is a party that went wildly off the track. In the middle 1990s, it went way too conservative. It gave too much away. And, you know, we see a little bit of that conversation around criminal justice reform, thank God. This is another stage of that conversation that really needs to happen. And we haven't quite gotten there yet.
Do you find that those who continue to push this line about reducing government dependence feel that the current welfare program structure as it is has worked in any way? I mean, I cited at the beginning of our conversation this recent study from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities showing that the program is reaching fewer poor people. Are some supporters of this program turning around and saying, look, that means that it works, instead of, you know, sort of basically cherry picking statistics instead of actually examining it as a whole?
I think that's exactly what's happened. And to some degree continues to happen. One of the things that that I looked at a lot for this book, Ensuring Poverty, was the stream of reports that come out of those mainstream Washington, D.C. think tanks. And the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities tends to be very good, and I rely on them a lot for some of the basic numbers. But some of the others, like the Brookings Institution, which supposedly is a Democratic think tank, or the American Enterprise Institute, you know, I don't quite understand it. It just reads to me like propaganda or ideology. And they seem to think that they can build on the so-called consensus of the middle 1990s and the so-called success of welfare reform, you know, to move forward into new areas of social policy development. And I think it's completely insane and even murderous, you know, murderous or maybe genocidal if we think about particular communities that are being affected. But there is a lot of talk like that in Washington. There is not a lot of feminism in Washington. And the way I read it, there's not a lot of reality check, you know, about what they're saying. And they're looking so hard for common ground of a kind between the conservative wing of the Democratic Party and one portion or another of the Republican Party that I think it just, you know, it obscures the whole debate and distorts the whole debate. They won't get away with that anymore.
You just used two incredibly strong words, murderous and genocidal. Explain that a little bit more. How exactly do you make the case if you were speaking to a member of Congress who likes this idea of reducing dependency, fostering personal responsibility, all of these, you know, individualistic, all of these buzzwords that have this idea rooted in American individualism? How would you explain to them that these policies are really genocidal? I mean, that's strong.
Yeah, well, it's sad. I think the data are pretty clear. We have good data from public health researchers, among others, that indicate that in states that implemented this welfare reform in a particularly draconian way, that we got more, those states got was more death. You know, people are dying earlier than they should if they're low-income moms with kids. And I guess it's not that surprising if you think about all the kinds of health indicators. Poor people in America are under incredible stress, and that psychological stress that causes mental illness, or even can be a species of mental illness. It's
physical stress. Suicide rates have gone up sharply.
Right. It causes suicide. It causes diabetes. It causes heart disease. It causes lack of sleep because people are working two jobs, and that becomes an additional health stressor.
Which stresses out children too, right? The children that are in these families.
Right. And, all of the studies that we know about trauma, losing a home is a trauma, being homeless is a trauma, experiencing physical violence or having your mom be a victim of violence, that's a trauma. And, when we really think about what's going on in the most impoverished families, like those situations are common. It's common to lose your housing. It's common to get into a relationship with somebody who's not that great and who may even be violent because he has some resources that maybe you need and your kids need. The reason I call it genocidal is because I'm afraid that the only reason that some American politicians are willing to tolerate it is because they think it's happening to some other category of people, and they understand that category as a racialized category. And I don't think they would. I don't think they would tolerate it if they thought like that these were, women like me, moms like me, or moms like my mom, moms like my spouse. I don't think it would be a tolerable situation to them.
But aren't white women also struggling and suffering who are among the poorest?
Yes, they are. They are. And one of the myths about welfare has always been that it was a majority black program or something, and that's never been true. But the problem is that the image drowns out the reality.
The welfare queen stereotype that Reagan promoted.
Right. It's racialized. It's propaganda. It's imagery. And that becomes a category that kind of a dumping category for people in Washington.
Well, Felicia, what do you think it's going to take to change these priorities? I mentioned there's always money for militarism. There's always money for, all sorts of things, tax cuts for the rich, which now we know that the tax reform bill that the Republicans passed is really stressing out state budgets as well. There's less money in the Treasury, which was their goal all along, right? To use that as a justification for cutting social spending and welfare programs. So they're just going right along with this train that they've started, but something's got to give.
Yeah, something's got to give. I learn a lot from friends of mine who are organizers, and what they say is, you don't create your campaign for the people who are just a no, right? And there are some people in America who, especially on this issue, on the issue of welfare and public support for moms and kids, they're just a no, a really hard no. So, okay, let's leave them alone for a while. I'm not going to worry too much about, people who are hardcore Trump voters, who are hardcore anti-welfare. But I think there are a lot of people who call themselves liberals or feminists or progressives who are not educated on this issue and who maybe are a little willfully uneducated about this issue because it's convenient to say that they're whatever, tough on poverty or tough on poor people. And so I think those are the people really to get and to apply pressure to. It might not be persuasion. It might be pressure instead, of the kind that some of the new members of Congress are willing to really enact. We could say, look, you don't get to be Speaker of the House if you don't take another look at this issue. You don't get to be a Democratic nominee. You don't get to be in a position of leadership if you're not willing to look at the mistakes that were made by the Democratic Party in the 1990s, and if you're not willing, to be good to your word about being a feminist. This is what it looks like to be a real feminist, not a BS feminist.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Felicia. Good luck with the book, and thanks for sharing your perspective on this critical issue.
Thank you.
My guest has been Felicia Kornbluh, Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. Her earlier book was called The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics and Poverty in Modern America. We've been discussing the new book that she's co-authored with Gwendolyn Mink. It's called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RUWithSonali. Ali.